Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law. Please be seated.
Thank you. At this time, we're on record in Mont Bar Enterprises, Inc. versus the City of Idaho Falls. Matters before the court for oral argument. Jared Allen will argue on behalf of the appellant, Lamont Bar Enterprises, and on behalf of the City of Idaho Falls, Blake Hall, and will argue, and Ryan Jacobson will appear only. Any preliminary matters?
Nothing from the appellant, Your
Honor. No.
Very well, you may proceed, sir.
Justice Burdick, Honorable Justices, I'm Jared Allen. I'm pleased to represent Lamont Bar Enterprises in this matter. And I'm going to get right to it. I believe an important starting point is to recall that with the adoption of the Idaho Tort Claims Act, the legislature intended to provide an expansion, not a contraction of government liability. As the court articulated in a fairly lengthy narrative in Sterling versus Bloom, the court recognized that it was a further departure or an additional departure from the doctrine of sovereign immunity, and the legislature had determined that the government, with very specific exceptions, would be liable, whether acting in a government or in a proprietary capacity, if a private person in like circumstances would be liable. The legislature did identify certain exceptions, preserving government immunity in certain circumstances, but it is inconsistent with that departure from historical immunity to conclude that the legislative intent was to expand government immunity or contract liability for claims that had long been recognized by this court as falling outside of any government liability. Specifically, those claims when the city is acting or a government entity is acting in a proprietary capacity. It has always, or at least long been the case, that when acting in a proprietary capacity, the government is liable in the same way a private individual would be. In fact, there are three specific cases that have been repeatedly cited in the record that are factually indistinguishable from this case. Those are the Skaggs Drug Center versus Idaho Falls, C.C. Anderson versus Boise, and Usley versus City of Pocatello cases, all of which involved almost the exact same circumstances.
I'm curious, you didn't mention the Doria Enterprises case is also a factually indistinguishable case. Do you think that case is different than this?
I do believe it's distinguishable. I believe it's distinguishable for a couple of reasons. The first one is it didn't relate to the water system. It related to the sewer system, which is a distinguishing factor. The sewer system is not identified as a public utility in the public utility statute. The water system is identified as a public utility. So when the legislature said if you get into the public utility business, you must maintain that in a safe condition. That was applicable to the water system, but not necessarily applicable to the sewer system. An additional and very important distinction, though, is that in Doria, the city was exercising ordinary care per its statutory obligation. It had a statutory obligation to flush its sewer system every other year. It had exercised its discretion to flush its system every year. So it was actually going above and beyond its statutory obligation, which is another distinguishing factor. Each of those cases, the three I referenced, Skaggs, C.C. Anderson, and Yearsley, the court affirmed municipal liability on the principle that each of those cities was acting in a proprietary capacity and therefore was subject to liability for damages arising out of negligence under the same rules as applied to a private individual. I would submit that that is the state of the law. That when the city is acting in its proprietary capacity, we don't even get into this discussion of discretionary immunity or design plan immunity.
I need you to say that one more time.
When the city is acting in a proprietary capacity, we don't even get into the discussion of the immunities articulated in the Idaho Tort Claims Act because that was the state of the law before the Tort Claims Act was passed. Cities were already liable when acting in the proprietary capacity. And if the Tort Claims Act was intended to expand liability, which the court clearly indicated in Sterling versus Bloom it was, then it doesn't make any sense that it would also contract liability that predated its passing. Does that make sense? Does that answer the question?
I was just needing you to sometimes to help me process it. I just needed you to say it again rather than I wasn't really asking a question.
Okay. So I'm going to follow up with that question. Where's the line between proprietary and design?
I don't know exactly where that line is.
But you know when you see it?
But I know that there's a healthy historical record in this state that running a municipal water system is proprietary. Each of the three cases referenced clearly held that the city was acting in a proprietary capacity by operating the system. Notwithstanding that expansive intent of the Idaho Tort Claims Act, the district court below applied discretionary immunity under 69041 to conclude that essentially the law as articulated in SCAG and C.C. Anderson and Yearsley no longer applies. I believe the district court's grant of summary judgment was in error. There are some key facts that I want to focus on because I think that they are decisive and should have, but were not. The district court did not draw the inferences in favor of the appellant when it considered these facts. The city operates a public drinking water system over which it has exclusive control. The city adopted a water facility plan in June of 2015. Prior to adopting that plan, the city did not have a pipe replacement program. Prior to adopting that plan, the city had 30 years worth of data regarding its water main breaks that revealed that the city's cast iron pipes installed between 1920 and 1959 were, and these are the city's words, past their design life and in need of replacement.
Well, the ones that failed were beyond their design life.
The one that failed was of that iteration. It was installed in 1958.
But they're not saying all of the pipes that were put in between 1920 and 1959 are bad. They're saying that the ones that have failed that are of that era were bad.
If you take a look at the record, and it's at page 254, what the conclusion of the engineers was that based on the break record, you could conclude that cast iron pipes installed between 1920 and 1959 were beyond their design life, irrespective of whether they had already broken or not. It was their conclusion that pipes of that material, that the breaks gave them enough data to say that pipes of that material installed in that time were past their design life.
Wasn't there evidence in the record that there was a 75-year life expectancy for these pipes?
There is, Your Honor, and that is the expectancy, right? But Skaggs and Yearsley and C.C. Anderson all stand for the proposition that the city is on notice that pipes deteriorate, and they don't deteriorate at a defined rate. There is no, you know, definitive means. That's an expectancy, but it's not conclusive. And the city, under that case law, has an obligation to monitor its pipe system and ensure that it's...
Right. So if a pipe has a life expectancy of 75 years, it's reasonable to expect there'll be a certain amount of degradation at 50 years, that it's not going to be perfect, and then magically at year 75, they start to malfunction.
Correct. And based upon that degradation, it could become past its design life ahead of that 75 years. In other words, no longer be a viable...
Well, I guess that's what I'm asking. There's a difference between design life and life expectancy. Because you've used both terms, and I assume they were the same thing, but you're using them as if they're different.
When a pipe is designed, it is expected to last that long. But it may degrade at a rate rapider than anticipated, more rapid than anticipated, and exceed that design life earlier than expected because of the degradation that wasn't anticipated. Right.
Well, let me ask this again. I don't want to get you bogged down on this, but if we are informed from the record that a pipe has a 75-year life expectancy, can we assume from that that it has a 75-year design life? Or is it, are
we
talking
assume
apples and oranges?
To have a 75-year design life.
Okay.
But the flip side of that is if your fail records indicate that pipe is breaking at a faster rate than normal, then it has apparently not lived up to its design life or its life expectancy.
So you indicate that the city has an obligation to monitor those aging lines. I understood that Mr. Richards said in deposition that once they're buried, there's not much can be done to inspect integrity. So how is the city to accomplish that other than adopt a policy as they did to take these out at a relatively consistent rate, or whatever, however you want to characterize it?
Yeah, the court in Skaggs made some suggestions, one of which was to have a pipe inspection plan, right, which the city didn't embrace. Another is to establish records of your breakage rate, which the city did embrace, but the city didn't do anything with it. The city effectively ignored that data until it had roughly 70 miles of pipe that is now beyond its design life. It could have drawn that conclusion earlier and adopted a plan to replace that pipe earlier, but it elected to ignore the data. The Tort Claims Act is to be construed in favor of liability and limit the exceptions. That's kind of an important starting point. That's not to say that cities are always liable, but we start from that place that if the city has done something that a private enterprise would be liable for, then we start from a place of liability. And the exception relied upon by the district court set forth in 6904 only applies in two specific circumstances, but they're specific and distinct circumstances. The first one is if the city is applying, or if the injury arises out of an act or omission arising from ordinary care in reliance upon the execution of a statutory or regulatory function, then the city is immune. Or if it arises from the exercise or performance of a discretionary function, then the city is also immune. In other words, if an injury results from the government carrying out a statutorily or regulatorily mandated function without the exercise of ordinary care, there is no immunity, irrespective of the discretionary function argument. That's the first prong of 6904. The second prong only arises if the city is not acting in the capacity of carrying out a statutorily or regulatory mandated function. In this case, the city was carrying out a statutorily mandated function. The city wants to circumvent this step of the analysis and jump right to the two-pronged test of Doria, but we don't even get there because the city was in the process of carrying out a statutory obligation. The most instructive case on this, I believe, cited by either party is the Bingham versus Idaho Department of Transportation case. Now, it was disapproved in part by the Lawton case, but that was with respect to design plan immunity, not with respect to discretionary and function immunity. In fact, Bingham actually the Lawton case cited to and followed Bingham with respect to discretionary function immunity. That case stands for the proposition that the distinction between these two immunities is an either-or distinction. In other words, the execution or implementation of a statutory or regulatory policy is not discretionary. And so the second prong of 904 cannot apply. For immunity to apply, that implementation of policy must have been carried out with ordinary care. The central question in determining whether 904 immunity applies, as determined by the district court, is whether the city was carrying out a discretionary function or...
Excuse me, sir. Judge, come here a second, will you please? And I'm sorry for the interruption. I'm sure that this has to do with the noise.
Which we don't mind.
keep going. That's what this note says. Thank you, Judge. Please excuse me, sir. It's the 911 memorial service, and we're just sorry we can't participate.
And I hadn't even tuned in on the noise. Although I did lose my place.
I'm sorry.
The city was implementing statutory policy. 61302 requires a public utility to maintain its facilities to promote safety. And 61702 provides that if a public utility omits to do an act required by the laws of the state, it's liable to the persons affected by the failure. Those are the statutes that were relied upon by the court in C.C. Anderson, including the city of Boise was liable when a pipe failed there. The maintenance of the water system is governed by this law. The city may have some discretion in how it goes about accomplishing the task of maintaining the system, but it does not have discretion in maintaining it in a safe condition. As this court articulated the principle in Bingham, quote, while it is true that the department has some discretion in the placement of signs and the determination of speed limits on a highway, that discretion is confined by policy considerations that have already been determined by the legislature and the department. Similarly here, the city may have some discretion, but that discretion is confined by its obligation to maintain its water system in a safe condition. It may have discretion in how many employees it sends out or how frequently it sends them out, but it still has the obligation to maintain it in a safe condition. And if it falls afoul of that obligation, then it hasn't met a statutory obligation and discretionary function immunity does not apply. In addition to the statutory obligation, and it's already been discussed a little bit, but I want to get into it a little more. The Skaggs, C.C. Anderson, Yearsley cases definitively hold that when a city, in these circumstances, fails to maintain its system and damage results, the city is liable. And not only is the city liable, but the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur applies. And that becomes important because one of the city's arguments is there's no evidence of negligence. But res ipsa loquitur is its own evidence of negligence, and the determination of whether additional evidence submitted by the defendant overcomes that presumption or that inference of negligence is a jury question. That was addressed specifically in the C.C. Anderson case when they discussed res ipsa loquitur. The court said whether or not there is sufficient evidence to overcome the inference is for a jury to decide. It's not for the district judge to decide on summary judgment. Importantly, the holdings of Skaggs, C.C. Anderson, and Yearsley were all reaffirmed as recently as 2008, meaning that the Idaho Tort Claims Act did not alter the law of those cases. That was in the Hansen versus City of Pocatello case. Now, in that case, there was not liability, but the reason there was no liability found was because of the article of injury, the meter covers on the city's water system were not within the exclusive control of the city, and the person had become injured on a meter cover. Because it was not within the exclusive control of the city, the res ipsa doctrine did not apply. The jury had not found negligence, and the issue on appeal was whether or not the res ipsa doctrine should have applied. The conclusion was that it shouldn't because of the lack of exclusive control.
Did you have a theory of liability for the city other than res ipsa?
Yes, I think their own data, their own report establishes their negligence. In other words, by disregarding the data as it came in and allowing their pipes to deteriorate past their design life, the city failed its obligation to maintain its system in a reasonably safe condition.
Well, you talked earlier about the insurer. Is the city insuring the quality of the water system?
No, I don't think the city has an obligation to insure, but it does have an obligation to exercise ordinary care. And the failure to pay attention to your data that you're collecting for that specific purpose, presumably, ignoring that data, disregarding that data, and allowing those pipes to continue to deteriorate past their design life, is inconsistent with that duty of care.
Have they existed beyond their design life?
Yeah. That's the city's own conclusion.
This pipe wouldn't have been beyond its design life.
Yes.
75 years? It's put in 58.
Its expected design life at the time it was installed was 75 years. Its actual design life, per the city's engineer's conclusion, was that it had expired prior to 2015. In other words, these pipes deteriorated faster than expected, and the city had the data in its hands to show that.
So the city should have replaced all those pipes in 2015?
Well, the city should have had a pipe replacement plan in place for a long, long time before that. Per the statute. I mean, the statute says its obligation is to keep it in a reasonable state condition. Electing to not have a pipe replacement plan and just ignore what's happening with your pipes is inconsistent with the statutory obligation, and I think is indicative of negligence.
Is that the subject of expert opinion?
It is not. Well, that it's indicative of negligence, is that the subject of expert opinion? No. That the pipes were allowed to exceed their design life because there was no pipe replacement plan? Yes, that's the subject of the city's expert opinion. That is the subject of the water facility plan. It specifically makes those two conclusions. The city did not have a pipe replacement plan, and this pipe in particular, the pipe of this material type installed during this window of time, had been allowed to exceed its design life or had deteriorated past its design life. Now, we've already discussed Doria, so I'm not going to get back into that unless there's additional questions about it. But it is decidedly distinguishable based on the two issues indicated. Also distinguishable, but leaned upon heavily by the city, is the Jones case. That's Jones versus City of St. Mary's. It's likewise distinguishable in that the court did not conclude that discretionary function immunity applied. The court concluded that it might, but it didn't have a sufficient record. But then what the court said that was most important, in my view, in that case was this, and it clearly stands for this proposition, that when the city assumes responsibility for maintaining water lines, quote, then it would be obligated to perform those activities with due care and would be correspondingly liable for any failure to do so. Now, we believe that the record, the water facilities plan, establishes negligence. But even if it doesn't, the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur has always been applicable in cases like this one, should be applicable in this case, and if applied, provides sufficient evidence of negligence to allow this case to go to the jury, and summary judgment should not have been granted. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. On behalf of the respondent.
DPS is on members of the court. My name is Blake Hall. I represent the City of Idaho Falls in this case. And it is interesting to me that the appellants in this case want to rely upon Yearsley, decided in 1951, Anderson, decided in 1962, and Skaggs, decided in 1965. I'm actually old enough to remember some of those cases, but not all of them. And want to ignore what the Idaho Tort Claim Act provides for, which was adopted in 1971. Additionally, what they claim is that we are subject to the Public Utilities Code found in Title 61. If you look at where municipalities get their authority or authorization for the creation of a domestic water system, it is found in Idaho Code Section 50-323. That's the authorization. If you look at Idaho Code 61, Idaho 61 specifically defines what is the definition of a public utility? A municipal water system owned by a city is not included. That's found in 61-129. And the definition of a water corporation is found in 61-125. Also does not include a city-owned municipal water system. In fact, what you find under Title 61 deals with one thing, and that is public utilities subject to the jurisdiction of the Public Utilities Commission. And so if I own a water corporation and I want to change rates, I can't just change those rates. I have to go through the Public Utilities Commission in order to obtain permission from them to ensure that I can change rates. Cities do not have that obligation, do not have that requirement. The Idaho Public Utilities Commission does not exercise jurisdiction over cities. Now, the state legislature does, and DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, can also. However, the plaintiffs have not cited to any authority under the municipal code, nor any authority under state statute, or any authority under any rules or regulations from the Department of Environmental Quality, which says that the city municipal water system has an affirmative duty to do certain things that would be applicable to this case. And so when we look at this case, the applicable law is the Idaho Torts Claim Act. The Idaho Torts Claim Act, which was adopted in 1971, specifically provides for liability if the public entity acts negligently, whether it's in a governmental function or a proprietary function, and then says in under the immunities, however, we are going to grant certain immunities to public entities. If you look at Skaggs, Anderson, Yearsley, you won't see any discussion about the immunities because they didn't exist. The Tort Claims Act had not been created at that time. And additionally, counsel's claim that Hansen reiterates the proposition in Yearsley, Anderson, and Skaggs, I would suggest, is misplaced. Hansen was my case. I'm familiar with the case. We never, ever raised the issue of an immunity in Hansen because, to us, the issue that was involved in Hansen was an operational matter. It was not a discretionary function matter. It was not a design matter. And so that the court and the two issues that were raised in front of Judge Randy Smith, who heard the case in this courthouse, was whether the city had notice and whether there was any evidence of negligence. And in that case, this court held that Judge Smith was accurate in concluding that res ipsa would not apply because this was not, even though it was a city-owned water meter, it wasn't in exclusive control. That's the only thing that case stands for. What we have to look at here is what Judge Watkins did in this case. And Judge Watkins, in my view, went through a very thorough and appropriate analysis of the Idaho Torts Claim Act and the immunities that apply under the Idaho Torts Claim Act. Under the discretionary function immunity, decisions involving the consideration of the financial, political, economic, and social effects of a particular plan are likely discretionary and will be accorded immunity. That's the Lawton case. And the court went on to indicate why we were doing this. And that is that we want to permit governments, in fact, we want to encourage governments to adopt policies when they recognize that there are problems, to address those problems, and we're going to give them immunity so long as they comply with the discretionary functions that they adopt. We have lots of them out there. You know, public entities adopt policies with regard to sign maintenance because we can't replace every sign and check every sign in a county or in a city every single day. So we adopt policies as to how we're going to approach that. And as long as we're in conformance with that policy, we are granted immunity. And that's good public policy. We want to encourage public entities to examine their infrastructures. And so, for example, in Doria, also a case I'm highly familiar with, as it was my case, in Doria, the city of Blackfoot decided that they had limited resources in being able to address every potential problem that could occur with their sewer program. And sewers are a proprietary enterprise, just as a water system is a proprietary enterprise, so there is no difference. So when they are addressing what are, and how they're going to handle that, they adopted a policy. And that policy they adopted was to clean out, to blow out their sewer systems on an annual basis. And as the court held in that case, when and how many financial and human resources should be allocated to perform a myriad task of running a city are basic policy decisions properly entrusted to other branches of government. And it would contravene the purpose of the discretionary function exception to allow the city's decisions on those matters to be reviewed by the judicial process. And that's exactly what we have here. We have gone through and done a study to try to determine, the city of Idaho Falls has tried to determine what is the condition of their water system. And uncontroverted testimony in this case is that the pipes in question have a life expectancy of 75 years. The pipe in question in this case had not surpassed that 75-year period. Then the policy decision that was made by the city was that we are going to, over the period of the next 15 years, go through our system and replace all of the older cast iron pipes that are starting to have problems. They haven't reached their complete useful life, but they're starting to have problems. And we recognize they're starting to have problems. And interesting enough, what are the types of problems that we find and that would suggest, what the report suggests, contrary to what was represented here, is that the way you can tell if that cast iron pipe is starting to get towards the end of its life is that you'll have rusting. And you'll have leakage because of that rusting. Or you'll have a problem with the coupling. And there'll be rusting at that coupling, and they'll be starting to have some problems of that of leakage of that nature at that location. And it goes on to say that we're finding those problems primarily in soils located on the east side of the river, the Snake River in Idaho Falls. And so we're going to prioritize the oldest pipe and the pipes that are in the types of soil where we are able to identify and find that problem occurring. Because we have limited resources. And we have limited manpower. We do not have the ability to snap a finger like that and simply replace everything. So we have to adopt, in our discretion, we adopt a policy that allows us to address the problem. And that's what the city did. Now, interestingly enough, in this case, the pipe in question is not on the east side of Idaho Falls. It's on, and it's in the record, it's in the map, it's on the west side of Idaho Falls on Skyline Drive in Brentwood, in an area where there had not been any significant or prior problems of rusting or leaking of couplings associated with the pipe. Because it was within its 75-year lifespan. So there were problems there of that nature. And that's what we're trying to address. What happens in this case is not a leak because of the useful life being exhausted or a coupling coming loose. What happens in this case, again, uncontroverted by the affidavit of David Richards, is that we have a shear break. We have a shear break that occurs.
Before we continue down the path of talking about the facts of this case, let's go back to the law for just a moment. Is the provision of a domestic water system a proprietary function?
I believe that a sewer system is a proprietary system, a water system is a proprietary system, and by proprietary, the Idaho Torts Claim Act specifically says that those, that it covers both governmental functions and proprietary functions. And the reason I would define it as a proprietary function is because when I get a bill each month from the city, they send me a bill and they are charging me so much for sewer, so much for water, so much for garbage collection, which is also a proprietary function.
So why then, I mean, if we agreed that it's a proprietary function, why do we go and ask ourselves, is the specific plan, if you will, to address the problem a discretionary function? Why do we do that analysis again? Because it seems to me what ends up happening is basically you insulate every decision on the part of the city as a, quote, discretionary function. So in other words, your negligence just becomes discretionary.
I don't, with all due respect, I don't agree with that analysis because you are not insulating every decision. You're only insulating those decisions which this court has set forth would be those decisions which are made in consideration of financial, political, economic, and social effects of a particular decision. Now, obviously, if we were in the process of replacing a water line and we left it unattended and it leaked out and ran into somebody's house, it wouldn't matter that we had a plan in place with regard to the placement because that's an operational matter at that point. It becomes operational with regard to how we go about not replacing those lines in a non-negligent fashion. And that's why it doesn't apply to operational aspects.
So would you agree, Mr. Hall, that if the city had not implemented the plan that's now in place, that the city would be liable for this leak?
Well, I think there are other bases upon which the city could be would not be liable. Those aren't involved in the decision from Judge Watkins. This court, for example, just approximately a year ago in January of 2018, had to decide an issue with regard to Haight versus the Idaho Department of Transportation. And the issue in that case of where an accident occurred was whether or not the Idaho Department of Transportation was on notice of a defective condition. And in that case, there was no evidence that there was any notice, actual or constructive, that there was a defective, that the Department of Transportation had a defective condition. Likewise, in this case, I would submit to the court that the city of Idaho Falls had no actual or constructive notice that there would be a shear break at this location. An absent notice, we would not be liable. And so I think there are other alternative bases for which we would not have liability in this case. I didn't attempt to address that at this point because that isn't the basis upon which Judge Watkins made his decision, although we did argue that he didn't reach that issue. I do believe it's an appropriate alternative basis, as this court itself set forth in January of 2018.
So I don't think I understand the answer to Justice Degner's question. Would the city have been liable if they had not adopted any plan to update their pipes?
The answer is maybe. Okay. And the reason is maybe because then it becomes based on whatever evidence might be presented. We believe in this case that the city still would not have been liable because under Haight versus Idaho Department of Transportation, the city had no prior actual constructive notice that there would be a shear break at this location, and therefore, under the court's reasoning in Haight, the city would still not be liable.
But the city is still on notice that the pipes are failing at a faster rate than their original expectation.
I don't think that's quite accurate. What I believe is more accurate is that the city is aware that on the east side of Idaho Falls, where the soil conditions are different, that they are having some problems in some areas with pipe that are over 50 years of age and nearing 75 years of age where they are having some problems there with rusting and leaks associated with rusting. That's why they prioritize the under their policy where they're going to go forward and replace the pipe.
On the east side of the river as opposed to the west side of the river,
right.
The west side of the river will follow after the east side is done?
Correct. And the reason for that is because they're not having those kind of problems on the west side of the river. And having recognized that, using the discretionary function authority that they have as policymakers, which this court itself has concluded shouldn't be subject to a judicial second-guessing, they are granted immunity.
But when you talk about if something is an economic expense or a political consideration, aren't you just saying everything should be immune? I mean, that's one of the worries that I have in this case, is that by affording this immunity that we immunize negligence. And I guess maybe to a certain extent that's what immunity is about, but I'm sympathetic to Mr. Allen's clients who had their basement flooded because the pipe failed. So where's the line between proprietary and design or discretion?
There's a large difference between the design immunity, which again was not implicated in this case.
All right, let's deal with discretion.
With the discretionary immunity, I understand the court suggested its concern that we're providing immunity for any kind of negligence. And certainly, if we're negligent in an operational standpoint, then there is no immunity. That court has made that clear. So it's not across the board. Interestingly, though, in Jones versus the City of St. Mary's, which deals specifically with a water decision, the timing of this one, I think, is quite fascinating because it was decided in the same year as the original case dealing with functional and qualified immunity. And the court went on to say that the district court didn't have the benefit of our prior decision in Bloom, and so we're going to cut them some slack in that regard. But it's interesting to me. They say, for example, if, for example, the evidence on remand indicates the city, due to budgetary constraints or other factors, made a policy decision not to inspect its water mains and fire hydrants, such a decision would be discretionary, as it would involve planning rather than operational activity. And the city would be immune from liability even if the decision was negligently made. Now, in this case, I don't believe there's any argument that the determination that the city made to have a complete study of their water system done was negligent. In fact, the evidence of this case shows that that they had the study done. The study was submitted to DEQ. DEQ approved the study and the recommendations of the study, and the city adopted those recommendations to provide for a replacement of water lines on an appropriate schedule over a period of 15 years. But they made that decision to replace those water lines over 15 years. Now, if that decision to do so was negligent, according to Jones versus St. Mary's, which deals specifically with a water system, this court has said that that decision itself would be immune from liability. So the city itself would be immune from liability because they made that decision based on policy decisions, budgetary constraints, and other factors. The only evidence in this case clearly demonstrates that the city of Otto Falls made its decision with regard to pipe replacement, its pipe replacement program, based on manpower restraints, budgetary restraints, and a prioritizing as to how and when pipes would be replaced. It had not yet outlasted their life expectancy.
Mr. Hall, you raised an issue that I wanted to get to before you run out of time. In your brief, you suggest that we could affirm Judge Watkins' decisions on alternate grounds based on the design exception that's set forth in 66-9047. However, Judge Watkins denied relief on that basis. So since you've not filed a cross appeal, how can we consider that issue as alternate grounds on appeal here?
I don't think it can, because we did not file a cross appeal, Your Honor, unless the court rules that that the court itself. There's a couple things we did in this case, Your Honor. You'll notice that we didn't request attorney's fees because we're sympathetic to the appellants in this case as well. We were hopeful that we might be able to resolve this case prior to getting to this point, but obviously we were not. And so we didn't file a cross appeal as well, even though I personally think that Judge Watkins was in error. We wanted to at least provide that to the court.
But whether the design exception applies really isn't an issue we can decide then, correct?
Well, what the court has done in other cases that I've seen in the past is the court has, even without a cross appeal, the court has said we can't sustain the decision on the basis that the court ruled in this case, but the evidence clearly establishes that on these alternative grounds there is a basis to uphold the decision.
But to do that, we'd have to conclude that Judge Watkins erred. And that's not an issue before us on appeal, correct?
Because he didn't, in my view. Correct, Your Honor. The only other final thing that I want to point out is that the plaintiffs have relied upon appellants on Oppenheimer Industries versus the State Grand Board, claiming that that requires an affirmative duty. It's interesting because I think that case actually stands for a proposition that's in the best interest of to help the city, in that what that case stands for is if there is a specific statute in place that says you shall replace water mains every 20 years or 30 years or 40 years or 50 years or whatever the legislature or DEQ could determine by way of regulation, which would have the effect of law, and we were in violation of that, then that case would apply, which is what was occurring with regard to a grant. But decisions made under statutes and regulations which leave room for policy judgment are the exception. And those are the ones that specifically fall under the discretionary function. I have nothing further, and thank you.
Hold on just a minute. You may have already answered the question, but I don't remember your answer.
Okay.
Is the provision of sewer services a proprietary function?
Yes.
Okay.
It is. And my basis for concluding that is that under the budgetary system set up by the legislature for cities, cities have tax funds, and then they have what we call sometimes enterprise funds. And those enterprise funds are proprietary funds. Water is one of those proprietary funds. The money comes in there. There's a limitation on where we can spend that money. There's a recent case, Hillview versus the city of Pocatello, which I'm involved with, and the same firm is involved with, that goes into that at some depth. That case involved both sewer funds and water funds, which are proprietary, as would be garbage collection and so forth. And so when you receive your bill from the city of Boise, or I from the city of Idaho Falls, there's a specific amount charged for each proprietary fund associated with those public entities. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. How much time does the appellant have?
8 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't anticipate taking the entirety of the events. Mr. Hall said something. Let me begin by saying that I hope that my city fathers are considering the financial implications of every decision they make, but that doesn't make it a discretionary function. And Mr. Hall uttered an important phrase, and I think it draws attention to the question that Justice Brody asked of Mr. Hall. He said, quote, "The city adopted a policy allowing it to address the problem." The problem already existed. That is where the city went afoul. It allowed the problem to come into existence without ever doing anything to address it. And only after the problem existed did it take action.
Now, so you're basically arguing that even though it may be a plan that would in fact have immunity under the Idaho Tort Claim Act. It was not done timely, and therefore it is exempt from the Idaho Tort Claim Act.
If we were arguing that that plan was somehow negligent, yes, we would agree and acknowledge. But our claim is not based upon that plan. Our claim is based upon the fact that the city allowed the problem to come into existence before the plan ever existed. It should have had a plan years ago, decades ago, but it didn't have that plan. And something of an ultimate irony, it was criticized 54 years ago for not having that plan. And it did nothing. It just waited for it to happen again. Now we're being criticized for relying on that authority because it's old. Well, it's old enough that the city could have taken some action on it. But I want to answer that question. Why are we focused on Skaggs? Why are we focused on Yearsley? Why are we focused on C.C. Anderson? First of all, because they're factually indistinguishable. Second of all, because every one of them found that the city was liable. More importantly, they were all reaffirmed in 2008 with this language. A city is subject to liability for damages arising out of its negligence under the same rules as are applied to private individuals or corporations. That is why 61302 is applicable. And if you look at C.C. Anderson, this is the language from that case. The conclusion we reach in this case is also in harmony with the duty imposed by statute upon a public utility, citing Idaho Code 61302, 61702. And the court concluded that the city of Boise was liable for the negligence resulting in a flood in its city, damaging retail space. I think we've addressed it adequately already. Daria is distinguishable, and Mr. Hall neglected to mention this, but Blackfoot adopted a policy that complied with its statute, with its statutory obligation. It was flushing every year. It exceeded its statutory obligation. The city of Idaho Falls did not. It only adopted a policy after it had allowed a problem to come into existence. I want to read from the record, specifically from the water facilities plan, because I think there's some considerable confusion on Mr. Hall's part as to what that plan concludes. So I'm going to read this to you. The break counts indicate, this is referring to the 30 years worth of data on break counts. The break counts indicate that cast iron pipeline installed between 1920 and 1959 accounts for approximately 70% of the city's breaks or repairs. Descriptions of the types of breaks and repairs performed on the 1950s era, that's specifically the pipe we're referring to, cast iron pipe include many joint leak repairs and clamp type repairs of rusting and cracked pipelines. These failure types indicate that the material is past its design life and is in need of replacement. That's specifically referring to the type of pipe we're talking about, which was a clamp type repair, and for which there was precedent less than a mile away in the same neighborhood. On Stimson Avenue, they had sustained a break roughly a year prior, also a clamp type repair. The city was on notice. The city knew, should have known for better than a decade, that this pipe was becoming obsolete, and it took no action.
You say a clamp type repair. Mr. Hall says a shear break. What's the difference?
There isn't one. A clamp type repair is the type of repair that is used to
for
a shear break.
Very good. Thank you.
And I think you could find that in the record in Mr. Richards' deposition.
Thank you.
You described that very clearly. The city was criticized 54 years ago for its failure to maintain the system. In response, it asked the court to change the law in Yearsley and C.C. Anderson. The court rejected that request. Here we are 50 years later, facing the exact same issue, with the city making the exact same request. All three of those cases are still good law, and the city is asking the court to ignore them. The city had an affirmative obligation to maintain its water system in a safe condition. It negligently failed to do so, ignoring warning signs and allowing pipe to exceed its useful life. neither discretionary function immunity nor design plan immunity apply. Court should reject the city's request to disregard precedents and reverse the findings of the district court and remand this case for further action.
Thank you, sir. Matters now under advisement. We'll render a decision.
Please stand.